From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. More than half of House Democrats support impeachment. We'll talk about how this could affect Nancy Pelosi's longtime opposition to it. Plus, potential math and science teachers require an extra bit of dedication to their craft. How much?
He said that it was either my marriage or my teaching.
Find out how the Cal State system is helping students not have to make that kind of a choice. It's all ahead on Take Two.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Friday. You made it, and hopefully you got by this week with a little help from your old pals here at Take Two. Coming up, ever seen those little free libraries in your neighborhood? A little box on a post where you take a book or give a book? Well, imagine that being stocked with food.
Two doors on the front say, give if you can, take if you need. No judgments, no lists, no signing up. It's just, it's there. And it's a resource.
We'll tell you about the little free pantry movement popping up in LA. Plus, more men are getting into early childhood education, but they faced some stigma. We'll talk about that in about 20 minutes. But let's kick this Friday off with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, more than half of House Democrats now support impeachment proceedings against President Trump. And that puts Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a bit of a strange spot. Meanwhile, Hop on Harris was the theme of the night after the Democratic debate on Wednesday, Senator Harris, that is. But did her critics get it right? We'll get into those stories and more with Jack Pitney. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Good to see you, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us, our patron saint of California politics, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Hello, Carla.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right, let's hop in with the latest on impeachment efforts in the House. Support passed the halfway mark on Thursday after a lawmaker from Florida announced his support, and that brings the count to 118 of 235 voting members. Carla, what has swayed the lawmakers?
Well, you can thank or blame Robert Mueller, because even with his understated appearance, those dry one-word answers and, you know, the disappointment, the lack of drama, he has really shaken loose some Democrats. And Representative Salud Carbajal of California today became that magic 118 to publicly support the start of the impeachment hearing. And that's, you know, the 23rd lawmaker to do so since Mueller testified on Capitol Hill. It's been a steady drip. And, you know, Democrats like Tom Steyer, who are running for president, many of the cable pundits, you know, have been pressuring those House members, saying, what are you waiting for? Of course, it's significant that the House member that matters most on this one, as you mentioned, Nancy Pelosi, she's not there yet. And I think that's where everyone is watching Capitol Hill to see when she returns and what her move is going to be.
Yeah, Jack, Pelosi has seen this as a risky move. Part of the reason she's pushed for the investigation route instead. Do the latest defections put her in a position where she might have to respond?
She is responding, but she doesn't want to bring it to the floor just yet. Her mantra is investigate and litigate. And she could also say that an impeachment inquiry is actually underway. The House Judiciary Committee filed a memo with a federal court that declares pretty much just that. What really matters is the August break. What will members of Congress hear when they go home? Are people even going to raise it in the first place? Are they going to be against impeachment? Are they going to be for impeachment? If they find that there is some groundswell for impeachment, this move will probably gain momentum. If not, it might not.
Jack, how much of her caution can be interpreted as a response, as a real response to this?
I think she does want to respond. If she had her druthers, she'd probably want to impeach Trump and remove him from office. But she has memories of the Clinton impeachment. And she also realizes very much that there's practically no chance of a conviction in the U.S. Senate. And that prospect hangs heavily on her.
Yeah, Carla, if it does go to the Senate, I mean, chances are they'd acquit President Trump.
Right.
What could an acquittal deliver to the president?
Well, I mean, many Democrats argue that what it will deliver is election 2020, the White House again. And, you know, from acquittal day to election day, you could imagine that his Twitter feed would read something like, no obstruction, no collusion, no conviction. And that is the message that the Democrats are hoping to avoid. And that's what really worries people like Adam Schiff. He heads the House Intelligence Committee, and he's saying, look, there's no, you know, they can't make a case to the Senate that he's called it the cult of the president's personality. But he says Democrats have to make a case to the American people. And the worst possible case, he says, is taking this impeachment case to trial, losing it, having the president acquitted, and then having an adjudication that his conduct is not impeachable. So, in other words, Schiff and Pelosi both are saying, hold your fire at least a while until maybe issues like the grand jury material comes forward and hands Democrats more solid information, evidence.
If there ever was an acquittal day, can you imagine what that day would be on social media? Every phone would blow up, I think.
It's mind-boggling to think about it, and I think that's what's scaring at least some of the Democrats like Schiff and Pelosi. And I think we're going to see with issues like that grand jury material, this could be very significant in how they go forward and how they proceed.
So, Jack, let's imagine then a world where impeachment proceedings are the backdrop for the 2020 election. How would they change the tone of the race?
If it's possible to imagine, it would increase the political temperature even more. Talk about global warming applied to politics. Trump says that impeachment is, quote, a dirty, filthy, disgusting word, which is odd for a word that appears in the Constitution itself. And that gives you some sense of how seriously he takes it. If impeachment goes forward, the one thing we can guarantee is that both sides are going to be extremely passionate. And where that leads, that leads us to a place we haven't been to in a long time.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. All right. So when it comes to the president and California, what would you say? What would you call that relationship, Carla?
Dysfunctional? I don't know where to begin.
Adversarial? How about adversarial?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
So, okay, mark another one down on that list, because on Tuesday, Governor Newsom signed a measure that would require presidential candidates who want to appear on primary ballots to disclose their income tax returns. President Trump has not been that forthcoming with his income tax returns, and a handful of legal voices have weighed in on this. What's been said so far?
Well, you know, the governor's signature on the bill, which is SB 27, is going to be a battle royale heading toward the March primary. And actually, legal scholars are split on this. The U.S. Constitution already has mandated certain qualifications for a presidential candidate. 35 years old, a natural-born citizen, a resident of the U.S. for 14 years. But the question here is whether states have the legal right to impose further restrictions on those qualifications. And, of course, the Trump campaign says, no, that is not correct. That's unconstitutional. And they further argue that the bill violates the First Amendment, the right of association, that basically tells people who they can vote for and who they can't. But some very prominent legal voices have come out this week, including UC Berkeley Law School Dean Erwin Chemerinsky. And he has asserted that, no, this law is constitutional because it doesn't keep anyone from being on the ballot so long as they comply with this simple requirement that's meant to provide California voters with what he called critical information. And he said the state has the right to make sure voters have that information. There's the argument right there. We'll see how it plays out. But, you know, Jay Sekulow, the lawyer for Trump this week, basically said, we'll see you in court.
And, Jack, California has taken the Trump administration to court at least 50 times. What do you think? Is this less about the law and more about Gavin Newsom trying to send yet another message to the president?
Yeah, he's trying to send a message to the president, but one we can't really repeat on the radio.
We don't have the bleep button fast enough for you, Jack, so don't go there.
Let's say it's harsh. More seriously, he obviously wants to demonstrate that he's taking the president on. And the argument is this. He would say, I think, that Congress is hamstrung in the contempt process. The Trump administration has contempt for contempt of Congress. And he's fulfilling the role that Madison laid out in Federalist 51, that the states would provide a double security as a check on the federal government.
All right, moving on, Carla. Senator Kamala Harris faced a barrage of attacks on her record as both a California Attorney General and San Francisco's District Attorney on Wednesday. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard made one of the most talked about moments of the night with this.
Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. She put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place.
Yeah, Carla, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard really went for it in front of everyone there. Really quickly, what are the facts on what she was talking about?
You know, Gabbard, I know the Harris people are breathing a sigh of relief that it came from Tulsi Gabbard, who's barely alive in the polls, rather than coming from Joe Biden or Cory Booker. But look, Tulsi Gabbard was really playing fast and loose with the facts. On the issue of Harris putting 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and laughing at it, well, that number came from a very questionable conservative website. Neither Gabbard's team nor the state has been able to confirm it. And let's remember, marijuana sales and possession was illegal during under state law during Harris's time as attorney general when she was the top cop. So on the idea that she blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row, well, she's referring to the case of Kevin Cooper. And that what the congresswoman failed to mention there is this is a highly controversial case involving a gruesome multiple murder. And it is not a clear case by any means. You got people on both sides very, very passionate about it. The senator's campaign spokesperson told The Washington Post after the debate that Harris was not directly involved in the decision to deny Cooper's petition in 2016. Since then, of course, Gavin Newsom and Jerry Brown have called for more DNA tests. But the other one was the cash bail issue. That was another one that Tulsi Gabbard brought up. Yes, as DA Harris did push to increase cash bail, but that was 15 years ago. There was a different view of that issue at that time. Since that time, however, Harris has introduced bipartisan legislation to encourage states to reform it. So not cut and dried, but Tulsi Gabbard went for it, and it did knock Harris off on her heels. That's no question about that.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing, Carla, right? Because she did get the viral moment. I mean, it was all over the place that night. So even if she did, you know, play fast and loose with the facts, she still got what she wanted, I think, out of it.
She did, and I know that, you know, a lot of people who supported Harris said, why wasn't she more prepared for that attack? And she better be prepared the next time, because this is not the last time she's going to get attacked on the issue of her prosecutorial record.
Now, given the chance to respond after the debate, Harris pretty much said, hey, I'm the front runner. Obviously, people are going to come at me like this. And Jack, even though her record has continued to dog her, I'm wondering if it makes sense for her to Don Draper this, you know, the old quote, if you don't like what's being said, change the conversation.
Yeah, you don't want to get deep in the weeds in a debate. Leave that to the staff. And I'd add another Don Draper quotation, as he said to Peggy, get out of here and move forward. This never happened. It will shock you how much it never happened. Don't address it. Leave that to the staff. And instead, in the case of Gabbard, go after her on Syria.
I love that. It'll shock you how much it never happened. It's perfect. It's actually perfect. All right, you two. Okay, on the way out, I want to get your take on an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. It makes the case that Democrats are now much farther left as a starting point than Barack Obama was. Is that a fair point? Carla, let's start with you.
Look, when the White House and President Trump are basically throwing confetti and popping champagne this week saying the Democratic debate was attacking Barack Obama, yeah, I think they got a point there.
Jack, what about you?
What's fascinating is that support for the Affordable Care Act, and that's a position taken by Biden and Bullock, is now the moderate position. That's the centrist position. It's not the the very liberal position. They're saying, you know, we have something that's worked here. Biden said that. Bullock said that. And they're considered the moderates in the party. So that's an indication that at least some of the party, not the entire party, but some of the party has, in fact, moved left.
And Jack, one more thing, though. When it comes to Biden's strategy, he had to embrace his role in the Obama administration as vice president, right? There's no way he couldn't.
That's right. And it's not a bad embrace to have in the Democratic Party, going with Barack Obama, who has a 97% approval rating among Democrats, is a pretty smart move.
Jack Pitney is a professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Jack and Carla, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I have three aunts and a pair of female cousins who are all teachers. Now, all of them range from kindergarten to the third grade. And actually, a majority of women, that's pretty much par for the course in teaching, especially when it comes to early childhood education. Coming up, we're going to hear from someone who's trying to balance that out a little bit. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds, so stay right there.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Last fall, the Trump administration unveiled a proposed federal rule that would disqualify immigrants from legal residency if they've used certain public benefits. Now, there's been speculation ever since that the rule could push immigrant families to drop out of public health and other programs. So, has it? KPCC's Leslie Berstein-Rojas has been trying to find out.
Daisy Salinas does patient outreach at the Queens Care Health Center in East LA. Soon after the administration announced its proposed rule, she saw a rash of cancellations.
Individuals didn't want to come to the clinic, so they were canceling appointments. There were a lot of inquiries regarding public charge.
Public charge, that's what the proposed rule is called. It seeks to disqualify immigrants who apply for green cards if they've used various public benefits.
Some of these are Medicaid, SNAP, EBT, which is food stamps.
Medicaid is known as Medi-Cal in California. Food stamps are known as CalFresh. Federal housing and other assistance also fall under the proposal. In truth, adult unauthorized immigrants don't qualify for most public programs. Notable exceptions include emergency Medi-Cal and child nutrition. But people and families with mixed immigration status may access food, housing, and other aid through relatives who are here legally. Immigrant advocates worry these families may drop benefits needlessly. At the Queens Care Clinic, I meet Angelica, a patient who doesn't have legal status. She says so far, she's kept her U.S. citizen kids on CalFresh and other benefits they qualify for, but she knows families that haven't.
I know people that really need the help because their kids, like, they need services, and since they're, like, so scared, like, to apply, they won't.
Anecdotes like these have circulated since at least early last year, when a leaked draft of the public charge rule first appeared. And at first glance, the numbers seemed to back them up. I looked at month-by-month enrollment data for several programs, Medi-Cal, CalFresh, and the Women, Infants, and Children Food Program, known as WIC. Medi-Cal enrollment has declined overall. That includes people using Medi-Cal who the state identifies as undocumented. The number of children enrolled in CalFresh has gone down as well. Then there's WIC, which provides nutrition benefits for low-income pregnant women, new moms, and kids up to age 5. Statewide participation in that program has also slipped.
I personally know people who have withdrawn.
That's Sarah Diaz with the California WIC Association. She believes some women are declining benefits out of fear.
I don't have the data points, but I do have the phone calls. And people telling me that they decided it was just safer for them not to participate.
But some experts say, hold on, it's hard to draw clear conclusions from the data. Hamutal Bernstein is a researcher with the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C.
I mean, it is very complex. There's a lot of things that affect benefits receipt.
There are variables, like the economy, for example. Medi-Cal officials say some people are likely dropping benefits as California's economy grows. Also, Bernstein says it's not just public charge. Other anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies from the White House may also be discouraging people from public programs.
It is difficult to draw the direct line between just this proposed policy change and all of the other developments in the immigration policy space.
That said, Bernstein thinks the public charge proposal is prompting some immigrants to drop benefits. The Urban Institute recently polled nearly 2,000 adults and immigrant families. 1 in 7 reported that they or a relative declined a benefit because they didn't want to risk losing a potential green card.
The fact that we are seeing such a large share of families reporting chilling effects even before a final rule is released suggests that even discussion about the rule is having impacts on people's actually choices about participating in programs.
Back at the Queens Care Clinic in East LA, Daisy Salinas says the staff is trying to keep people enrolled, at least in programs that would not be included in the public charge rule. For example, MyHealth LA, a free program offered by LA County. Even so,
we noticed that a lot of individuals were not renewing MyHealth LA.
Salina says the staff has tried explaining to these patients that being in MyHealth LA wouldn't jeopardize their applications for legal residency. But,
you know, even after explaining all of these issues, they still don't want to go through with the enrollment process.
Perhaps not surprisingly, countywide enrollment for MyHealth LA has also dropped. A final public charge rule is expected soon. Covering immigration, I'm Leslie Beristein Rojas.
All right, to education now. Women dominate the K-12 teaching field. And when it comes to early childhood care and education, it's estimated that males make up only 2 or 3% of the workforce. KPCC's Prisca Neely has a story of one man who's trying to change that.
Billy Truong never dreamed he'd be working in early childhood education.
I had no intentions whatsoever to be in this field. I had a great job.
You will not believe what he used to do just 8 years ago.
I was working at a Hollywood nightclub as a promoter.
Yep, you heard that right.
I was the one hiring the go-go dancers, the DJs, some of the security guards.
Now his work life sounds a little less glamorous.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, chapter 9.
He's an adjunct professor teaching child development classes at several schools, including East LA College.
If the child has not fully developed his or her emotional and cognitive development, how will we be able to observe?
His journey from promoter to professor started with a babysitting gig.
My sister called me up one day asking if I can keep an eye on the twins.
His twin nieces were just a few months old at the time. And while Truong loved children, he had no experience with infants. So his sister left him some extremely detailed instructions.
How to prepare the milk in the bottle, how much ounces, and how to feed them, and how to burp them, and what happens if they drink too much.
This experience made him super curious. He wanted to learn more about the early years of life.
And so I came to East LA College and just took a child development class.
I know, kind of crazy, right? But he was hooked. He'd learn a concept in class, like baby sign language, and he'd rush home to put it to use right away with his nieces.
And it was wonderful.
A couple of classes and one super encouraging professor later, Truong was getting his associate's degree. He started working in preschools. Then he got his bachelor's and his master's in human development from Pacific Oaks College. And now he's helping to train the workforce. As one of very few men in the early education field, he wants his students to know he's not the only one.
My name is Robert Boyman. I am the executive director for Pacific Oaks Children's School.
So my name is Edwin Cruz, and I'm one of the kindergarten teachers here at the center.
I'm Gregory Uba, and I actually work in a family child care home in Sacramento.
Those men were all presenters at a recent conference Trong organized for men in early childhood professions. That last voice, Greg Uba, is one of the champions of bringing men into the field.
Well, I've been in early education since 1984. So if being old and persistent counts, then yeah, I'm one of the champions.
He says there are a lot of reasons that men don't typically do this work. One is the low pay. According to one study, even a lead preschool teacher in California makes just $30,000 a year on average. That's $50,000 less than the average grade school teacher.
But the social stigma, I think, is even harsher for men entering the field. The way that some parents look at them, I don't want him changing my kid's diaper, or I don't want him supervising my daughter in the bathroom, or that becomes a little bit oppressive.
To cope, he's focused on finding support from other male educators. He started a Facebook group for men in childcare, which now has members from across the world.
And putting on conferences like this so that guys start connecting.
You've been doing this how long? Yeah, pay sucks, but I like it.
Most of the conference attendees were actually women, but there were takeaways for them as well. Meredith Abbasi teaches early childhood education classes at Cal State LA. She has over 120 students, and only two are men.
I try to not make my male students like the unicorns in the room, but they're very rare.
The takeaway for her, preschool leaders have the power to change the social stigma.
Directors just need to stay strong and be able to articulate that there isn't any risk in hiring male teachers in ECE.
And that's the realization that Billy Trong is hoping for. At the end of the day, he wants young children, boys and girls, to have more male role models.
Sooner or later, we're going to get people accustomed to it, and the next thing you know, it's going to be a social norm. It just takes a few people to start the movement.
And this fall, Trong is helping to organize another local conference for men in early childhood professions. Covering early childhood, I'm Prisca Neely.
And Prisca is with us now in studio to talk a little bit more about this. Hello, Prisca.
Hey.
All right, so as I listened to that, I couldn't help but think about the male educators I've had in my life, mm-hmm. and I didn't have one until the fourth grade, Catholic school. He was a priest. So
yeah.
There you go.
Fourth grade for me, too, Mr. Fratt. I actually touched base with him a couple years ago. But yeah, outside of higher education, teaching is really dominated by women. And in elementary grades, it's about 20% are male teachers. And secondary grades, it does go up about 41% nationwide. But yeah, mostly women.
All right. So part of this is the pay. And you mentioned that throughout your reporting. But I'm always surprised to hear that because the cost of childcare in preschool can be pretty expensive.
Yeah, there's a real disconnect there for sure. And the money that parents pay, you know, it's probably a big chunk of their income, but that does not trickle down to the people doing the work. And to care for infants and toddlers especially, it takes so many more adults to be able to handle the children. So the salary gets divided between a lot of people in addition to, you know, administrative costs and rent. It's mostly women of color doing this work. And early care and education just isn't prioritized in the same way as primary education, even though, you know, I should add that early childhood educators are a lot more often expected to have bachelor's degrees now. But the state doesn't really robustly fund it in a way that can make it financially sustainable. So that can keep men away. But one of the men I talked to said that, you know, lots of women are breadwinners and they've worked in childcare to get by. So if you love it, you can make it work. But the social stigma is really the bigger issue in terms of how men are perceived when they do this.
All right. So that stigma, you talked to some other men in the field. What do they say about pushing past that stigma?
Yeah, I heard a lot of really just lovely things from men who are so passionate about doing this work with young children. And they're basically trying to shift the narrative. And you know, one of the things that can really help is just building relationships with parents at the places where they work so that they understand why they're there.
Being able to say, I'm here for the same reasons everybody else is. I want to do right by the children and make sure that we're laying healthy foundations so that they become successful adults.
It's not a babysitting career. It's pretty much teaching, educating the next generation that are going to be the doctors, the scientists, the lawyers, and things like that.
So that was Robert Boyman, who's the executive director for Pacific Oaks Children's School, and Edwin Cruz, who's the only male teacher at East LA College Child Development Center.
All right. Now, your piece touched a little bit on the importance of role modeling. So let's get into that a little bit more, because it seems, or it would make sense to me, that more men in the field could have a big impact on young male students.
Yeah. And, you know, the early years are so important to who we become as adults on so many levels. And there's some research that shows that boys are more likely to consider teaching professions if they have a male teacher. So it kind of becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy here. But I just love how Greg Uba put it. He's been working with young children for 35 years.
Little boys, if they see men in their lives, it gives a message that school's not just something you have to go to. You belong there because there are guys here too. It's healthy for the little girls that, oh, this person is going to be a outside of the family male role model, and he cares about me, and he's nurturing. That's how a man's supposed to be.
I just think that's such a beautiful idea there. And, you know, we know that children start to form perceptions about gender roles, you know, in preschool. So this really all just goes along with what I'm saying all the time, which is that children become adults and that we were all once children. So these things really matter.
That's KPCC early childhood reporter Prisca Neely. And one thing, spit of a sad day, Prisca Neely is leaving us. If public service journalism had a face, you would be right there.
Live on the radio.
It's true, though. You've really made a mark with your beat, one that your colleagues here admire and aspire to. So thank you very much, Prisca.
Thanks, A.
All right, science and math were not the most fun subjects for me in school. I always thought I just didn't have the aptitude for it, so I would just kind of tread water and survive. Problem is, that attitude is not that uncommon for a lot of kids, which then means there aren't as many college kids looking to become math and science teachers. Coming up, how the Cal State University system is trying to demystify math and science with some hard, cold cash. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. There's a teacher shortage in California. One recent report found that of 211 California school districts surveyed, 75% said they could not find enough qualified people to fill their needs. Now, to that end, the Cal State University system is giving an assist to future California math and science teachers the state has. $10 million in extra funding will be put toward an existing program aimed at educating the educators. Professor Debasri Rashadri oversees the Mathematics and Science Teacher Initiative on the Cal State LA campus. She joins me now. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as we mentioned, we have a teacher shortage in California, but why is it important to invest in the education of math and science teachers specifically?
Those are the subjects, along with special education, that we are having the shortage. Also, if you look at the different data points as how our high school students are faring in the international scenery in terms of math and science, you could see that we need to boost our students' preparation.
Yeah, we don't stack up very well, do we?
No, we are. I don't think so.
Now, this program has existed in the Cal State system for years now. Tell us how it's been working on your campus.
Yeah, over the years, we have been focused on various different things, such as streamlined curricula, advisement, customized roadmaps, field experience sequence, along our 1.5 years in high school, observing, analyzing, and tutoring the students, community college connections. We have been holding a conference to find out what their needs are, because community college students, they are facing this twice, because they are one domain, then they switch to our campus, and then they again switch to the ed department. So they have a lot on their plate. Thankfully, with the Math and Science Teacher Initiative support being doubled this year, we would be able to do many more things.
So let's get into that extra $10 million. So what kind of stimulus will this money give your program?
We would try to create more customized curricula for different subjects, preferably in science, because we already have a math fast-tracked option that where you can do your credential and degree in 4 years. Then we would provide extra support, financial support to our student teachers. And then we would try to give the mentor teachers that help our students with the field experience more support.
We're talking to Professor Debasri Rashadri, oversees the Mathematics and Science Teacher Initiative on the Cal State LA campus. Now, while enrollment in teacher prep programs has increased in recent years, school districts are struggling to fill these spots. In what way? Why are they having trouble?
Well, in my opinion, there are lots of people retiring and not enough people are going in math and science. And there is an attrition in these fields because along with the demand of the subject, there's also common core standards, new standards that are coming in. There's the administration side of the teaching, and there's a lot of paperwork that's involved with teaching. It is difficult, and a lot of people do not like that. And if you add on top of that, we don't pay our teachers very well, do we? We see that it's only dedicated people would go in who are not in it for money.
Now, we've been talking about the overall teacher shortage in California for some time now. What are the ripple effects of this shortage?
We are not able to staff the classroom, finding people with proper credentials. So we are sending, for example, a teacher with some other degree into the math classroom or the science classrooms. If you send someone with just a lesson plan, with no knowledge of the subject, there is nothing really elementary about math or science. They're all, even at the little small level, they are quite profound.
Now, another issue the program hopes to tackle is the makeup of the teachers earning their credentials. The initiative includes attempts to enhance diversity as well. Tell us what that looks like at Cal State LA.
We are fortunate to have a Latino student body building our student body. We have the majority of the students coming from Latino population. What we need to see, though, we need to recruit more in African-American population because we want our teachers to reflect the students and have the students look up to them and see someone similar to them. And they can think that, yes, I can do this too.
And tell us about how that recruitment starts and how far back do you go to try and identify potential teachers?
We go as far back as high schools, but I strongly believe that elementary school might be where we should start because once you form a fear of math, it will be very difficult to change the, you know, that student's path. One of the reasons is we send teachers, multiple subject credential teachers into the classrooms of grade one upward to almost to 7 or 8. A lot of them do not love math and they are actually sometimes very afraid of math and they often impart their fear of the subject.
Okay, Professor, it all seems like a very daunting and difficult task. But with funding like this and maybe funding at the national level, are you hopeful that we will see more retention of these teachers and that they'll stay in their careers a lot longer?
I'm always hopeful, but there are some points that, you know, frustrate me as well as the teachers. The reason I'm hopeful is because I have seen students that are organized, dedicated, knowledgeable, that want to go in the field despite the fact that they're not going to get paid much. And then they're going to spend lots and lots of hours. In fact, I have had a student come back from the field and give us a talk that he actually got married right about the time he started teaching. His marriage within a couple of years, or he said that it was either my marriage or my teaching. It was so demanding, but luckily his marriage survived and he's still teaching. But it really takes a lot out of your time and your family has to support you. So what I would do is request the administrators to not reduce the teachers by dictating the terms that what they need to teach, how they need to teach, what modes they need to be used, because they have been taught all of these in two departments, math and education. So let them have some freedom and that will not break the spirits of the teacher and there will definitely be less attrition.
That's Debasri Rashadri, professor at Cal State LA, telling us about new initiatives to help future math and science educators. Professor, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now to a different college campus. UC Santa Barbara is suing five major retailers over a light bulb. Specifically, those vintage-looking so-called Edison light bulbs, named so because they look like the ones designed by the inventor 140 years ago. They're clear with exposed filaments, and they're hanging in many restaurants here in LA and probably in a lot of backyards as well. UCSB says it has the patent on the filament LED bulb and argues that retailers such as Walmart, Amazon, and Target should pay up for profiting on the technology with its sales. Now, if successful, the university would get a cut of the royalties. UCSB filed a similar complaint with the International Trade Commission seeking a review of the alleged patent violations. All right, my little grandson Wyatt is on the 15 freeway heading south to visit his old grandpa. When he gets here, my weekend is done. It's booked. It's going to be full of smooches and selfies all weekend long. But if you're free, we got a whole list of fun things to do all over LA. That's coming up when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you take a walk around any L.A. suburb, you'll probably bump into a little free library. They're those birdhouse-shaped cabinets, usually sitting on a post on the edge of a sidewalk, stocked with books. You take one, you leave one. That's how it works. Now, the idea for little free libraries is to help build a greater sense of community and a love of reading. Now, take that exact same concept, but instead of books, you stock the cabinet with food. KPCC's Janaki Behta takes us to a local little free pantry where a quiet movement is taking off aimed at tackling food insecurity.
We are on the south side of South Hills Church here in Burbank, California, and on the Tohunga Avenue side, and we have this beautiful little blue pantry.
That's Tara Duffy, who lives in Burbank. She got permission to put up this pantry on her church's property about a year and a half ago. Duffy stocks a pantry once a week when her family goes to Sunday service.
Two doors on the front say, give if you can, take if you need. No judgments, no lists, no signing up. It's just, it's there, and it's a resource. And that's what really spoke to me.
Duffy was looking to give back to her community in a tangible way when she came across the Little Free Pantry online. It's a movement that originally began thousands of miles away.
My name is Jessica McClard. I'm the founder of the Little Free Pantry Project, started in my hometown of Fayetteville, Arkansas.
McClard credits the Little Free Library concept as her inspiration. She first came across one in her neighborhood about 5 years ago. Pretty soon, she saw three libraries in her neighborhood.
So there was something else going on in that space. And it seemed to me to have something to do with our desire to just reconnect with one another.
She says that around the same time, she was reading a lot about poverty and hunger issues.
The fact that the little free libraries even look like kitchen cabinets, I think all of those things came together for me and inspired kind of my twist on the idea.
Over 17% of Arkansas's population faces food insecurity. That's when someone lacks consistent access to nutritious food to live a healthy life. And some of the individuals dealing with food insecurity might not qualify for food banks.
When I launched the Little Free Pantry pilot, I really hoped that it would catch some folks who were falling through the cracks.
With some help, McClard built the first pantry and started stocking it with non-perishable food and personal care items. 2 weeks later, a stranger started a second pantry in her neighborhood.
There was some really important learnings with the launch of the second project because I liked it better than mine. She painted the interior of her project white, which makes the items inside more visible when it's dark. And there's lots of growth happening right now.
Now there are nearly 700 pantries mapped on the Little Free Pantry website, including international locations like New Zealand and Senegal. But McClard thinks there could be three times as many. Here in Los Angeles, three pantries have been identified, one in Beverly Hills and two in Burbank, including the one Tara Duffy stewards.
And I was here over the weekend, and it was completely filled up. And as you can see, it had been nearly emptied out. So it's definitely being well used. Currently I'm grabbing some water bottles to put in. Since it's been so hot, we want to make sure people have some access to water. So that's it for the water. And then we have some women's maxi pads, some baby wipes.
And you said you see personal hygiene items going the fastest?
They do. They really don't last long. And I think that kind of speaks to the bigger need that it could possibly be more homeless people and or just, I mean, anybody who needs a little help.
Food insecurity is a major problem in Los Angeles County.
Approximately 1.4 million adults and 573,000 children live in households that experience food insecurity. It's cutting across all geographic areas of Los Angeles County.
That's Michael Flood, chief executive of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. He says food bank distribution in LA County is up 22% in just the first 6 months of this year, and that's driven largely by the high cost of housing. It's hard not to feel helpless when systemic challenges like that are to blame, but Flood says when it comes to food insecurity,
you know, this is a problem that everyone can do something about.
For some, that means volunteering at a local food bank. And for others like Tara Duffy and Jessica McLard, it means starting a little free pantry.
You don't have to have a lot of money to give to the Little Free Pantry. A 42-cent can of green beans makes a difference to someone, and it doesn't take a lot of time.
When nearly 2 million people in Los Angeles don't get enough nutritious food, the roots of this problem run deep. And the Little Free Pantry doesn't claim to be the definitive solution.
There's so much complexity in a small, empty box.
But it's a start. For Take Two, I'm Janaki Mehta.
All right, finally, if you've got a blank calendar coming up for the weekend, we can help you out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, I've got a bunch of events to hit up. Actually, first off, did you miss Comic-Con this year?
I did.
I'm sorry.
I watched it from afar.
Same. Well, yeah. Today through Sunday, you can actually scratch that itch for anime and manga, because over at the Pomona Fairplex is Animanga. Mm-hmm. So think of it like the dessert to last month's anime expo in downtown LA. So it's even more Japanese pop culture and icons on display. There will be over 100 artists with works to shop. Plus, you can get some pro tips on how to be a voice actor from professionals who you can actually hear on animes and video games right now.
Sweet.
Plus, there's going to be a video game competition. And when you go, passes start at $15.
$15. All right. Now, that's not the only convention in town, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know how right around Halloween, you might go to a store and see Christmas stuff and say, this is too early.
All the time.
Yeah. So, well, just after July 4th is when I started to see Halloween stuff and said, this is too early. But I know Southern Californians love to be scared. So tomorrow and Sunday, go to the Long Beach Convention Center for Midsummer Scream. This is an expo, and it's the world's largest horror and Halloween convention. So you can shop for costumes and decorations, obviously. But there will be 13, unlucky 13, haunted attractions, plus panels and presentations like one on the history of Disneyland's Haunted Mansion. When you go, passes start at $33, but if you're an adult, you can actually bring up to 2 children ages 10 and under for free. Hopefully, you actually know those kids.
Hopefully, yes, you're right. Yeah. Hopefully, you do know them. All right, so what if I want to go outdoors, though?
Well, then I hope you've got an empty stomach, because today through Sunday is the La Habra Corn Festival. Let's just get this out of the way. I've got some corny jokes for you. You'll be amazed. This event is going to be popping. Okay, no more puns.
Why do you get to do the dumb
part? Because I wrote it.
Okay,
but this food fest celebrates all things corn with a corn parade on Saturday and an eating contest on Sunday. Plus, there will be a car show and live music, too. It's a fundraiser hosted by the local Lions Club. So while it's free, make sure to donate while you're there or just buy lots and lots of corn.
All right. One more thing, because I'm shocked that you have something for sports fans.
I know. I can like this, too, just because I don't like sports in general. But finally, catch soccer star Megan Rapinoe and the rest of her team in Pasadena.
Everyone loves them. Yeah.
The World Cup winning U.S. Women's National Soccer team makes a stop on its victory tour by playing a friendly against Ireland at the Rose Bowl. These are hot tickets that start at $40, so if you saw them dominate on the small screen here, see them again in action yourself. And that game starts tomorrow night. Now, there's actually a lot more going on here this weekend. Check out our full list of events on laist.com. That is laist.com.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, eh?
That's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Skywalker-Galloretta and Leo Duran. Itzy Quintanilla helped us out this week as well. Austin Cross directed the show. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice, and Brandon Young is our summer intern. The program engineered by Hasmik Pogosian. Senior producer and editor this week is Megan Larson. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.